What does it mean to farm the sea? How aquaculture affects the people of Maine. We're all familiar with farmers of the land, but what about farmers of the sea? Aquaculture is a visible coastal industry in Maine with a significant impact on the state's economy and environment. But just how much farmed seafood ends up in our grocery stores and restaurants? And is aquaculture a green industry? I'm Keith Shortall, and today my three guests will help us understand the ins and outs of aquaculture. Sebastian Bell is with the Maine Aquaculture Association. Matthew Moretti is a Maine mussel farmer. They're both in our Portland studio. Joining us by phone, Dana Morse, an extension associate with Maine Sea Grant. New advances in understanding of aquaculture. This is Maine Calling. And welcome to my guests. I want to start with you, Sebastian Bell. You've been you're very familiar with this industry. And the story that has run repeatedly throughout the course of my journalism career about aquaculture kind of runs along these lines. There's a proposed aquaculture operation down east, say. Some of the locals like it because it means economic development. Some of the locals don't like it because it interferes with their view of the harbor, and that's not what they want to see when they wake up. And some of the fishermen don't like it because they fear it will interfere with their operation. And then environmentalists don't like it because they're afraid that some of the fish might escape and taint the genetic pool of wild fish. Is that story still being played out in Maine today, or has it changed?
Oh, I think it's changed a lot, Keith. It's interesting. Maine is a very interesting case study, I think, in terms of the evolution of how aquaculture fits into coastal communities. Like anything new, there are always concerns about something new, and I think people are surprised once an operation gets up and running how it fits into the local community. We are lucky in Maine in that we have had aquaculture in the state of Maine for over 35 years, and we've learned a lot from our experience over those years, both from a regulatory point of view and from a community relations point of view. And certainly we have had our ups and downs over the years, and many of the things that we did, particularly in the early years of the industry, I don't think were particularly helpful. We were not very good at communicating to local folks, and we often found ourselves in a situation where people were being told things about aquaculture that, you know, just weren't true to scare them. Having said that, you know, we're not perfect. We have continued lessons.
Can you give me an example of what people were told that wasn't true?
Well, a lot of it centered around environmental impact. There was a lot of concern, I think, about environmental impact. And the fact of the matter is Maine is really one of the world's leaders in environmental monitoring and management of lease sites and operations to ensure that there is minimal environmental impact. Now, you know, there's impact with anything that we do as human beings, whether that's building a house along a shore or driving a car on the road. But Maine really distinguished itself relatively early on as having a very aggressive and very proactive environmental monitoring and management program. And so what was being told about farms in other countries, for example, particularly places like Chile or China, just has never occurred in Maine and couldn't occur. We would have our permits pulled and be put out of business.
Yeah. Dana Morse of Maine Sea Grant, is that how you see it as well, that we've moved beyond that story?
I think in a lot of ways we have. Some of that dynamic still persists. As Sebastian mentioned, sort of the dynamics of change are difficult for most human beings in general. And so when a community that has not had an aquaculture operation in it before, for example, encounters that, some of those same things play out. But by the same token, I think there is a greater understanding on the part of Maine citizens generally. And there's also a better understanding of the dynamics on the part of our aquaculturists. And so, for example, one of the things that's really, I think, come to light over the last 10 years or so is that new aquaculturists or potential aquaculturists are sort of doing their homework. They're, instead of just filing an application for a lease with the state over a particular area, they're doing more work in terms of finding out not only just what their animals need biologically, but what the other activities are out there. So who fishes, who boats, who sails, who lives on the shore, and then trying to reach out to those different constituencies and find out how best to fit in. And it's an imperfect process, but what I think happens is that the aquaculturists themselves are realizing kind of the role that they're playing in that on-the-water community and how to sort of get what they want and what they need while recognizing some of the other uses, well, many of the other uses along the coast, because as you probably know, anytime anybody drops a buoy in the water, everybody knows about it 5 minutes later. It's a heavily used coast, and so new uses of those coasts are sometimes fought over.
Matthew Moretti, let's bring you in here. You're the proprietor of Wild Ocean Aquaculture, which is a mussel farm. What was your experience in trying to set this up? Did you have to win over the hearts and minds of locals as part of your business plan?
Well, we're a little bit unique to the situation because we actually bought into an existing company a year and a half ago. So we didn't have to go through the preliminary hurdles that most aquaculture operations do. We bought an established company that was 10 years old, and that company is actually Bangs Island Mussels. We have a lot of community interactions currently, especially with other lobstermen. We have developed a system, or it was in place when we bought it, that we encourage or allow lobstermen to set their traps near our rafts out in Casco Bay because they're actually becoming better lobster ground than they were before. So it helps the lobstermen out to have us there and helps us to fit in there as well.
I'm wondering, we're mentioning lobstermen, are there some lobstermen who may recognize, hey, well, you know, at least it's another marine business and not a condo unit or something that's going up? Is there some mutual support given that these are marine industries facing some of the same sort of hurdles, or are they still fighting against each other?
Keith, this is Sebastian. It's very interesting to me. I've been back in the state since 1989, and I've seen a real evolution in terms of the attitude amongst the commercial fishing community. And that was really crystallized for me when a group of us formed something called the Working Waterfront Coalition together. And that was, the key groups involved in that were the Maine Lobstermen's Association and the Maine Aquaculture Association, amongst others. I think that came to a head last year when we had something called the Cod Academy, where three out of the five people who went through that academy were active lobstermen, and they were looking for another way to make a living on the water. And it was just simply from their point of view beginning to examine a way to diversify their economic base.
Bigger picture question here. Aquaculture, though, is not of a scale that is going to solve any major food problems. It's not going to replace fishing. It's really more of kind of a way to raise specialty fish for higher end plates. Is that not fair to say?
Well, it used to be fair to say. It's not anymore. In fact, 2 years ago, aquaculture worldwide eclipsed wild capture fisheries in terms of the supply of seafood. So 2 years ago, there was more seafood produced worldwide through aquaculture than commercial fishing. I don't many times you hear people who are trying to drive a wedge between working waterfront constituencies, they will try and post commercial fishing versus aquaculture as being a kind of a juxtaposition. I don't see it that way at all. I think we're all working waterfront citizens. We all, when the Mayday goes out on the radio, nobody asks, are you a lobsterman or are you an oyster farmer? They ask, where are you and how can we help you? I think commercial fishing is always going to be there. Aquaculture is just going to be another way to make a living on the water, but it is definitely becoming worldwide a major way to make a living on the water. The challenge we have in the U.S. here is we are behind. We do not have anywhere near the level of development that they do in other countries. You know, in Maine, we only farm around 1,300 acres. That's about the size of the Portland Airport. It's relatively small space-wise compared to other marine resource users.
How big could you imagine Maine's industry could grow to in terms of acreage?
Well, we have 148 coastal towns in the state. 40% of the state's population lives in those towns. We've got 5,300 miles of coastline, and we've got about 100 farms in the state. We have about 82 startup farms on top of those 100. So right now, we are pretty much in every coastal town with at least one operation. You don't, by and large, even know those are there. If you compare us to a place like Norway that has a coastline of 7,000 miles and they have over 4,000 farms, and in many places in Norway, you don't even know they're there. It's relatively easy to fit in and become a neighborhood farm.
Norway, I went once. We have family there, and we got off the plane, and I was struck by how much I thought it had turned around and landed in Maine. It looks like Maine in a lot of ways. Are there lessons to learn from the Norwegian aquaculture industry, both good and bad?
Yeah, I think there are. I lived there for a bunch of years, actually. That's where I learned the trade. I think one of the lessons to learn is to not be afraid of change and growth, but conversely, be careful about how fast that happens. In Norway, probably in the early years of the industry, they grew too fast, and that resulted in perhaps some farms located in areas that were not the best sites to be located from an environmental impact point of view. On the other hand, Norwegians are a very interesting group of people. They are very can-do. They reminded me a lot when I was living there of what I thought this country was like probably 150 years ago. Roll up your sleeves and solve the local problems and get it done. So I think there's lessons on both sides to be learned.
The major species – yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Dana.
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. If I could just add a little bit to that, some of that dynamic in terms of what Sebastian was saying, start off slow and kind of learn those lessons, that's already underway in Maine. So if you take a look at the people who are growing shellfish and now seaweed in the state, if you had looked at that roster of people 15 or 20 years ago, what you would have seen was almost exclusively people who had started from the scientific or academic side and decided that they liked to work outside and they were good at it and they could have a growing business. Now what you find, partly because of the things that we've talked about earlier, is that there's a sizable number of people in the shellfish and the seaweed game, which are the sort of the constituencies I deal with, who either are now actively fishing or still commercial fishermen and they grow something, or they have, in some cases and for some reason, segued out of the fishing industry and decided to stay in seafood by growing something. So the experiment in that transition and marriage of catching fish versus growing fish is already starting. So a lot of the lessons that we've been kind of observing and learning over the last decade are because some of those sort of pioneers from the commercial industries are entering this relatively new industry.
And salmon, oysters, and mussels are the big money makers presently?
Yeah, those are our three principal species. We grow a total of 15 species in Maine, actually, right now. But salmon, oysters, and mussels are the big three.
Talk a little bit quickly before the break here about seaweed, though, because it's just amazing to me. It seems like we wouldn't have to grow seaweed, but I assume it's a certain type of seaweed that has more value than the rock weed that we see everywhere.
Well, Dana should take that question because he's involved in a really interesting project, and Matt is too.
Yeah, I'll start off by sort of hand the ball off there. Seaweed harvesting on the wild basis has been around for quite some time, and we have some companies in the state that have been doing business in harvesting and creating products out of seaweed for 30 years plus anyways. And as with other seafood products, Maine has a pretty stellar reputation for that kind of stuff. But partly because of some of the research that's been going on in Maine and Connecticut, and partly because of some really leadership shown by Maine companies, Ocean Approved most notably, there's an increased focus on products from seaweed. And so Matt and I and some others are involved in one project. But the seaweed industry globally, my understanding is it's about a $7 billion industry, and that the United States use of seaweed-derived products is about $1 billion. And so we're not talking about chicken feed here. Well, actually, we sort of are because it's used in animal feeds of all kinds of things. But it's a sizable industry. We have some very appropriate species that grow here naturally that we can take advantage of, and it's a new product and a new way to kind of get involved in harvesting and producing marine species on an aquaculture basis.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about that and take some calls. On the other side, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will take your questions and comments. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about aquaculture on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You can't just have an Olympic Games, you know. There's security and logistics and lots of waiting in line. And in London right now, there's a certain amount of anxiety about that last one.
Britain looks embarrassed when people are queuing at the airports. And frankly, the Olympics is a disaster waiting to happen.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Stress tests, not for the banks, but on the Tube and at Heathrow. That's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30. As you know, many businesses and organizations in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting MPBN, either on MPBN radio or on MPBN television, visit our website, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information, or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And of course, thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Packard Judd Kay, providing strategic marketing consulting, communications, research, and training services online at PackardJuddKay.com.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Aquaculture in Maine. Our guests are Matthew Moretti. He's with Wild Ocean Aquaculture, LLC, and grows mussels. Sebastian Bell, Executive Director of the Maine Aquaculture Association. And on the line with us is Dana Morris, Extension Associate with Maine Sea Grant. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We were talking before the break about seaweed. What are some of the products that are being developed that incorporate seaweed? And that's to anyone.
Well, there's a lot of different products, and it's actually quite amazing the variety in products. There are human food products. There are, as Dana alluded to, animal feed products. There are nutraceutical and pharmaceutical products. There are feed ingredient products for human foods that are things like things that are binders and other things. So there's a whole series of things. And then on top of that, there's biomass and fuel production. So there's a lot of different possibilities out there.
I'm wondering, a coworker of mine came to me and said, you know, I moved here recently and said, I went to a Maine restaurant and there was salmon on the menu and it wasn't Maine farm-raised salmon. Where does our farm-raised salmon go? Does it mostly go out of state or some of it available on local plates?
No, it's available locally as well. It is quite special in Maine. All of the aquaculture products, and this includes most of our seafood products, not just aquaculture, are recognized as being kind of the top of the quality grade. And so there's a tremendous demand for them. We cannot produce enough product. And they as a result of that demand, they get sent all over the country. They're principally in the North American market in the U.S., but we get paid a premium for our product because of the known quality and because we're within a day's shipping of 150 million consumers. So, yeah, a lot of our product does go out of state, but some of it does stay in state as well.
And there are some interesting comparisons in terms of how, I guess it's called feed conversion ratios, which come from NOAA, which looks at how much feed goes into a particular species and how much protein or meat comes out of it. And salmon compares really favorably with certainly with beef and pork and chicken. Is that, talk about that, if you would, and the significance of that.
Well, you asked a question earlier about how does aquaculture or seafood, you know, compare to other food productions in terms of where we got to get most of our food. I mean, I think most people don't realize the kind of food crisis that we're headed into. By the year 2050, we're going to have 9.6 billion people on the face of the earth. And the standard of living in China and India in particular is rocketing upward. So their food consumption is also – their caloric consumption is rocketing upward. It is one of the unique things about growing food in water is it's energetically much more efficient than growing food on land because aquatic animals don't have to maintain themselves against gravity. For you or me as a human being, it's about 10% of our metabolism goes to just resisting gravity. And the second thing is aquatic animals are the same temperature as the water they grow in, so they don't have to heat or cool themselves. Those two things alone combined make them much more efficient than land animals in particular. And so producing food in water is going to increasingly be part of how we feed the world.
And in terms of numbers, according to NOAA, it takes 1.2 pounds of feed to produce 1 pound of salmon compared to 8.7 pounds of feed to produce 1 pound of beef. So almost eight times as much feed per pound. We're going to start taking some calls here. Let's go to the other side of the country, to California, and Brian. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Kind of an interesting perspective that I'm going to offer you, that when you get it right to the consumer, and I work in a restaurant, and when people say that tonight's salmon is it farmed or is it wild? And when I say it's farmed, I would say 9 times out of 10 they refuse that offering. What is the downside of farmed salmon, and what are some of the answers that somebody in the food industry can give to consumers that are concerned, rightly or wrongly, about consuming farmed salmon?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brian. And I'm surprised when you say 9 times out of 10 they refuse it. That's got to be a California thing, I think, because it's actually exactly the opposite on the East Coast. But you know, there has been a lot of money spent distinguishing farm from wild salmon on the West Coast, and it's principally come from some very large foundations, and it's been very effective, to be honest with you. What I say to everybody is it's actually pretty simple. If you have a choice between something that you can control the production of and control what it's exposed to, how it's produced, and what it's you know, how it's created, if you will, versus something that you don't know where it's been, you have no idea what it's been exposed to, and you have no idea what the impacts of that have been, it's probably a pretty simple choice. Does that mean that farmed salmon is perfect? Absolutely not. When we started farming 35 years ago, there were a lot of things that were done that were not great, and we have learned as we go. Does it mean that all farms are good? Absolutely not. There are good farms and bad farms. The one thing that we have been recognized for here in Maine is we were some of the first farmers in the world to go to what are called third-party auditing systems, where we bring in outside people to audit the farms for environmental impact, for animal health, for animal welfare, and then certify that farm to meet a certain standard. And that is a trend which, even though it started here in Maine, is now going all around the world. We have people coming from all over the world to Maine to look at how we do things here in Maine, and we're proud of that. And I would say to anybody who really has concerns, come on down. We'll take you out on the farm, and we'll show you what we do.
And also, in this case, Brian, Atlantic salmon is under pressure and in Maine rivers and has been protected. So, on the one hand, I guess you'd prefer, right, Sebastian? You'd want to say it would a farmed would be better, right?
Well, for sure. On the East Coast, our wild salmon stocks have been under tremendous pressure from a number of different environmental impacts, not so much to do with aquaculture, but more to do with just general human development and, impacts on the environment and habitat. And so, yeah, you are much better off. I mean, you can't get a wild salmon on the East Coast because they are listed as endangered.
That's why we don't get that question here. Brian, do you think you're equipped now to respond to your customers?
Just one other quick question, and I would be totally equipped. People tell me that the farms that are in the open ocean, if a fish that's within the farm jumps over the net and introduces himself into the wild school of salmon, there's harmful things that can happen as a result of that. Is that a misnomer?
Well, like any farm, you want to keep your farm animals on the farm. So that's the number one priority for farmers. And indeed, in Maine, again, here's a great example of where we signed a memorandum of understanding with three environmental groups in 2001, and we developed with them cooperatively what is now referred to as our containment management system. That model is, again, being taken all around the world to other farms, and it's, again, an audited model. There are many times if an animal escapes from a farm, whether it's a fish farm or a terrestrial farm, where there's little or no impact. There are times when if an animal escapes, it may have some impact, and the focus of the farming community and the regulatory community should be preventing those escapes or reducing the risk of those escapes, and we're fully supportive of that.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Lebanon and Arnold. Hi, Arnold. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. I guess the question I have is how is the production of aquaculture going to split up between factory systems, which use vegetables and worms and whatnot to produce feed for the fish in the system, versus farming in the lakes, oceans, and rivers. Factory versus farming in the wild.
So are you asking how much is going to be land-based versus how much is going to be in the ocean?
Yeah.
It's a great question. A lot of times you hear people believe that if you move all the farms from the ocean to the land, you're going to reduce the environmental impact, and it's, as with many things, it's not that simple. When you build a land-based farm, you have to build it close to a water source, so it's got to be coastal. You've got to obviously bulldoze that land, build that plant. In order to build a land-based system that would be comparable to, say, one of our salmon farms in the state of Maine, if you're familiar at all with downtown Portland, if you go by the Sprague Oil Terminal, that's the kind of scale facility you're talking about to be able to produce the number of pounds of fish that we produce on one of our average salmon farms. So it's not a small facility. The other thing is that you have to pump water, and that takes a lot of energy. So land-based systems are not, the environmental trade-off is not as simple as it sounds. The other thing I think from a farmer's point of view that we have big concerns about is in order to make land-based farms pay, you have to put a very high density of animals in there. And from our perspective as farmers, we have concerns about animal welfare. We really look at the land-based farms as being more akin to factory farms than the ocean-based farms that we currently farm with.
Thank you.
Yep. Arnold, thanks for calling. Let's go to Harpswell and Jim. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm actually one of those 9 out of 10 that don't take the farm raised for maybe the wrong reasons, but the reasons I've heard is that they may contain higher levels of either PCBs or fertilizer runoff that are in streams or in the watercourses in which they're farmed. So I wonder if you could comment on the content of the fish versus the wild, especially Alaskan salmon, and how does one know which farm salmon that is lying on the ice in the grocery store comes from a certified farm versus not?
Okay, that's two great questions, and I'll take the second one first. What I say to consumers always is when you go to the counter and you ask where the salmon comes from, oftentimes you'll get somebody behind the counter who maybe is a new employee or who hasn't had a lot of training on where their products are coming from, and they may not be certain about where that fish comes from. So ask to see the box. Ask to look at the box that the fish came in, and that box will tell you where that fish came from. It'll say product of Canada, product of the U.S., product of Chile, what have you. The other thing, with respect to your first question, also a great question, there were a number of years ago, there was some concern and controversy about whether or not there were PCBs in farm salmon versus wild salmon and what have you. It was the product of a study that was, again, paid for by a very large West Coast Foundation. And the bottom line is this. For us as farmers, it never occurred to us that we would even have to worry about PCBs in our fish. We never thought that that would be an issue. When that study came out, it showed that there were PCBs both in wild and in farm fish, and it showed that those levels were levels that were higher than people had thought about. They were below any levels that were of concern from a human health concern. But from the main point of view, we started to test our feed. And as soon as we did that and established thresholds on what was allowable in the feed, we were able to control what our levels are, and our levels are very low right now.
All right, we'll talk more about that and take your calls as well. We're going to take another short break. More of your comments and questions on the other side. Please stay with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, France and Greece vote out austerity. We'll look at what their elections mean for Europe's debt crisis and the world. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point this evening at midnight. And join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock, immediately following Maine Calling, for the Commonwealth Club of California. The speaker today is Timothy Geithner, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, who remarks on the U.S. and global economies ahead of the 2012 U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue. That's the Commonwealth Club of California. Timothy Geithner is the speaker at 1 o'clock after Maine Calling.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, aquaculture. Our guests are Matthew Moretti. He's with Wild Ocean Aquaculture, LLC, and grows mussels. Sebastian Bell, Executive Director of the Maine Aquaculture Association. And on the line with us is Dana Morse, Extension Associate with Maine Sea Grant. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. Matthew Moretti, most of the calls we're getting here, all lining up again, are about salmon. Are there no controversies in the world of mussel farming that we can talk about?
Well, mussel farming is definitely different from farming salmon. For one thing, we don't add anything to the system at all. We don't have to feed the mussels. We don't have to give them fresh water. We basically just provide the optimum environment for them to grow the best they can on their own. So we protect them from predators and let Mother Nature do the rest.
So it's pretty easy. What are the issues, mostly dealing with locals about use of the land or the
There are definitely some competing land use problems. There's a long tradition of commercial fishermen in Casco Bay. We're based in Casco Bay off of Portland Harbor, and there are quite a lot of lobstermen and other fishermen that have traditionally been there for a long time, and it can be difficult for us to kind of carve out our small place in the bay, but so far we haven't had any issues with that, and I think we fit in pretty well.
All right. Well, let's take some more calls to Brooksville and Jane. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. What's your question?
Yeah. My question was about the red dye that's added to the food for farmed salmon, and as you say that you've improved the way salmon is farmed over the past number of years, I'm wondering, have you found a way to remove that dye so that we don't have to have the salmon's flesh artificially colored?
So another great question, Jane, and good to hear from you again. It's been a while. So what you're referring to is actually it's a nutritional supplement, and it's basically put into the feed because the salmon cannot formulate it themselves. They can't create it themselves, so they don't manufacture it internally. And there's been a lot of kind of misconceptions out there about it being a dye or something that is injected into the fish or whatever. And basically, it's added to the feed because the salmon cannot formulate it themselves. There are two ways to put that in the feed. One is through a product which is a byproduct, a fisheries processing byproduct, shrimp shells or crab shells or in some cases, we've done some trials using some different kinds of algae as a formulation. And then the other way is a synthetic product called astaxanthin or canthaxanthin, and those are the things that people typically refer to as a dye. But it is not a dye. It's a nutritional supplement which is FDA reviewed and approved. And if we don't give it to the fish, then actually, from our perspective as a farmer, we are not fulfilling our stewardship responsibilities as a farmer and giving them what they need from a nutritional point of view.
Dana Morse, anything to add?
No, not on that one.
Okay.
Perhaps I misunderstood, because my understanding is that the flesh of wild salmon is naturally very red, but because farm salmon don't have to hunt for their food, they don't have the same type of muscle structure as the farm salmon, and therefore it was necessary to give it to add that red color. Am I incorrect in that understanding?
No, you're partially correct. So the wild salmon get it by, you're correct, by eating things like the shrimp or the crab larvae or any other crustaceans which are out there in the wild. As I said earlier, one of the ways that we deal with that is to use a fish processing byproduct, which comes from those fisheries. But in the case where we can't get enough of that, then we fall back on the synthetic additive. And if we didn't add it, yes, the fish would be a little paler, but it wouldn't be. Some folks have said they'd be gray or white, and that's not accurate. They would still be pink. They just wouldn't be as pink.
All right. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Camden and Beatty. Hi, Beatty.
Yeah, I can't believe somebody hasn't already asked this, so I hope I'm not repeating things for you. I've been concerned in the past about hearing that a lot of wild seafood was added into the salmon, the farm salmon feed, and that in itself had an effect on the fishery, on what was out there, because the salmon have to eat the part of the fish. It's not all grain, which would make a totally different kind of salmon.
So,
and the other question I had was about diseases and whether you feel that you've kind of got that under control, because sometimes things escape to the wild salmon. Of course, our wild salmon are in trouble. So.
Right. So I think you're referring to what Keith referred to earlier, which is our conversion ratio. And basically, we do use some fish meal and fish oil that come from wild fish stocks as ingredients in the feed. And the good news is, you know, when we started years ago, we had very high conversion ratios, and it took a lot of that fish meal and fish oil to grow a pound of salmon. Now the latest research coming out of both Norway and Europe and to some extent the U.S. is that actually we've got those inclusion rates down so low that farm salmon are actually net marine protein producers, not consumers. So they actually produce more marine protein than they consume. So that's something that we as farmers are very aware of and want to make sure that we deal responsibly with our feed ingredients, and that's kind of the evolution that's happened. Now, that's taken, you know, 20 years to happen, and in the early days, we weren't as clever about doing that. In terms of disease, we are probably, the state of Maine has probably the strictest fish health regulations in the world. All of our sites are monitored regularly by the state and federal agencies. If we ever get a positive disease head on a farm, depending on what that is, we can be shut down immediately, quarantined, put out of business, and we've got a pretty good disease fish health management in the state. We were amongst the first farmers in the world to use third-party biosecurity audits, which is where a veterinarian comes in from the outside, goes through the whole farm, audits 160 areas, and gives the farmer a report, and then also gives the regulators that report and talks about areas to be improved and areas to be monitored. So we've had we have historically in Maine every once in a while we've had a disease, but we've responded very aggressively to that. And I think if you talk to the regulators, they will tell you the same thing. We've actually been kind of pioneers in aquatic animal health management.
What kind of diseases are we talking about? Sea lice or?
Well, there's, I mean, like any farm animal, just like when your kids go to school, right? Your kids go to school and they get colds. It's the same with farm animals. Any number of disease organisms can come in from the wild and attack a farm animal just like they would a wild animal. When a wild animal is attacked by a disease, frankly, you don't hear about it or see about it because they die and they get eaten by something. On a farm, we're in the position of being able to observe our animals every day, all day long, sometimes through the night. So we spot very quickly if there's a change in behavior or something possibly happening, and that's where we react very quickly. The good thing about disease management in Maine, for example, is we have not used antibiotics in the state of Maine in our marine farms for over 7 years. Part of the reason for that is we basically farm our fish in a very proactive, low-intensity way, and that means that the likelihood that a disease is going to break out is reduced significantly.
All right. We just have a few minutes left. I'm going to try to work in a few more calls. Let's go to Friendship and Roger. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I've got a quick question about 40 years ago. I was a graduate student in mechanical engineering at the University of Maine, and the professor I was working with got a grant, some money from Sea Grant, to fund me, and I had designed at that time a submersible oyster raft, and that was 40 years ago. And I'm wondering to what extent now is Sea Grant and other entities funding or cooperating with the local universities to improve aquaculture?
You've got about 30 seconds to answer that.
Okay. There's plenty of work going on both at the University of Maine system and other institutions. And one of the things that's nice is that over the course of the last couple of years, I think we've seen more people with expertise, both from inside the industry and inside the academic side, find a home within aquaculture. So we could be talking about business and economics, food sciences, engineering, those sorts of things.
All right. Matthew, Sebastian, Dana, thank you all for joining us today. Matthew Moretti is with Wild Ocean Aquaculture, LLC. Sebastian Bell is Executive Director of the Maine Aquaculture Association. And Dana Morse is Extension Associate with Maine Sea Grant. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith and our volunteer Scott McAuliffe. Scott also answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We received help today from Rich Tozier and Nick Godfrey at our Bangor studio, as well as the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.